Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, Juneteenth. The United States officially celebrates the anniversary of the end of slavery as the push for social justice persists. Then, historic shift. Colombia charts a different course as the country elects a former guerrilla fighter as its first leftist president. And remembering our friend, we honor the life, career, and legacy of the longtime NewsHour political analyst, Mark Shields.
My favorite moments in television have been Friday nights with Mark Shields.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The long wait is over for families wishing to vaccinate their youngest children against COVID-19. Starting today, kids from 6 months to 5 years old were able to receive a child-sized dose of the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine in a few locations. Shots are expected to ramp up after the Juneteenth federal holiday. White House COVID response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha encouraged parents to get their children vaccinated.
We're lucky to have two choices. They're both exceedingly safe. They're both effective. If you really, so either one is fine. If you, there's some nuanced, subtle differences, you can talk to your family physician or pediatrician about them. But we've got two good choices here.
So far, the pace of child COVID vaccinations has been slow compared to older populations. Less than a third of children ages 5 to 11 have been vaccinated since they were given the green light last November. President Biden said today that he hopes to make a decision on whether to pause the federal gas tax by the end of this week. The move could save consumers as much as 18 cents a gallon. That comes as his administration is working to curb soaring inflation. In Ethiopia, witnesses now say the gun massacre targeting the ethnic Amhara people over the weekend left at least 260 civilians dead. The attack happened in the western Oromia region. It is believed to be one of the deadliest in Ethiopia's recent memory. Both residents and the regional government blame the Oromo Liberation Army. The rebel group has denied responsibility. Meanwhile, in West Africa, the Mali government said that Islamist militants killed at least 132 villagers in the central part of the country over the weekend in multiple attacks. The security situation has been deteriorating there as the decade-long extremist insurgency grows. To Ukraine, where Russian forces have unleashed a fresh barrage of attacks. In the eastern Donbass, they captured a town along a river that is key to taking the Luhansk region. Explosions also hit a food warehouse in the southern port city of Odessa as Russia targets Ukraine's food supplies. And in northeastern Kharkiv, a Russian ballistic missile struck a veterinary academy, leaving workers in despair.
I want to close my eyes, and after opening them, see that nothing has changed. Everything is still like when it was during the old happy days. I cannot convey feelings with words. It is not just emotions, but like my soul is crying.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky predicted that Moscow's attacks would intensify ahead of this week's European summit to decide whether Ukraine will join the European Union. Severe monsoon flooding has ravaged huge swaths of northeastern India and Bangladesh, killing dozens and damaging millions of homes. Local authorities estimate the floods have displaced more than 9 million people. The unusually high rainfall submerged entire villages. Residents have had to wade through their homes to save as many belongings as they can.
There isn't much to say about the situation. You can see the water with your own eyes. The water level inside the room has dropped a bit, but it used to be up to my waist. All in all, we are in a great disaster.
The seasonal storms have also triggered deadly landslides and lightning strikes across the region. Israel is once again headed for a new election, its fifth in just 3 years. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and his main coalition partner, Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, agreed today to dissolve parliament. Bennett had struggled to keep his political coalition together, leaving his alliance without a majority in the Knesset. Lapid will serve as a caretaker prime minister until the election is held this fall. And back in this country, the Biden administration has reached an unprecedented agreement with five Native American tribes to co-manage the Bears Ears National Monument in Utah. The Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service signed the deal on Saturday with tribal leaders. After centuries of living in that area, the tribes will now have more input into the monument's day-to-day management. Still to come on the NewsHour, 40 years after Vincent Chin's murder, we examined the state of Asian American civil rights. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter weigh in on the latest political headlines. We remember the life and career of longtime NewsHour analyst Mark Shields, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today marked just the second time in U.S. history that the federal government has recognized Juneteenth. The holiday celebrates June 19, 1865, when Union soldiers brought word of slavery's end to Galveston, Texas, freeing the last enslaved people 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. Amna Nawaz looks at the country's remembrances and the conversation around this history.
In Washington, D.C. today, Vice President Kamala Harris surprised students visiting the National Museum of African American History with a special message for Juneteenth.
Let this be a day that is a day to celebrate the principle of freedom, but to speak about it honestly and accurately.
In Galveston, Texas, home to the longest-running Juneteenth celebration, the past was alive. The Saturday event honored the last enslaved people in Galveston in 1865 and one of the men who spent his career making sure their stories were told.
My father, late and former state representative Al Edwards, was majorly focused on making Juneteenth not only a state holiday but also a national holiday. Everyone deserves to know the truth about the history that happened right here in Galveston in Texas.
Generations of black families, like Angela Milburn's here in Houston, Texas, have long celebrated this day.
I cherish this day and all the days that followed this one and that came before this because of what a lot of my ancestors went through and those that knew each other and the struggle that they did for us.
The so-called grandmother of that modern struggle, former teacher and civil rights leader Opal Lee, who stood by President Biden's side as he made Juneteenth a federal holiday last year.
Say yeah! Yeah!
In Fort Worth, Texas on Saturday, the 95-year-old Lee led her annual 2.5-mile march to mark the nearly 2.5 years it took between the Emancipation Proclamation and Union troops officially announcing the end of slavery in Texas. The work to end its long legacy, Lee said, is far from over.
Make yourself a committee of one.
Okay.
Because you know people who aren't on the same page that you are. And so you're going to have to change their minds.
All 50 states and the District of Columbia recognized Juneteenth in some form. Texas was first back in 1980. But so far, only 24 states and D.C. have made June 19th a public paid holiday, though more states could soon follow. The city of Boston marked the holiday with a weekend celebration of black arts and culture. Philadelphia marked the day with its first Juneteenth parade since the start of the pandemic. A celebration of America's story more fully told. Well, Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday certainly elevated conversations about black history and the legacy of slavery in America. But where are those conversations today? To talk more about that, I'm joined now by Professor Peniel Joseph. He is the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin, where he's also a professor of history. He's the author of the upcoming book, The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. Professor Joseph, welcome back to the NewsHour, and thank you for joining us on this holiday.
Great to be here.
So I want to reference something you wrote recently, marking this second Juneteenth that we're noting as a federal holiday here in the States. You said that you found hope
in what you called the resurgent interest in Black history that followed Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday. So I wanted to ask you, what was that hope based on? What were you seeing happening in the last year?
Well, I think the hope is based on the fact that the country really led in this case by both grassroots interest in Juneteenth and the Black community, but then President Biden and others is trying to confront slavery and the fact that we are a democracy whose roots are in racial slavery. And that makes us a complex place to live in, right? So when people say that the country suffers from systemic racism, they're not saying that because somehow they dislike or hate the country. They're saying that because they love the country. So Juneteenth sort of reflects a complicated history of America and American democracy, but paradoxically, it brings us closer to becoming that beloved community that Martin Luther King Jr. Wrote and spent his whole life trying to achieve.
You had this one line in a recent piece that stuck with me. I'll read it here. You said, as a federal holiday, Juneteenth now offers a window for Americans into understanding how the political is personal. What did you mean by that?
Well, these stories, you know, we have now so many great stories about people celebrating Juneteenth with their family and their friends over the decades. These were real people. So these are really personal stories. There are stories of Black people in Galveston celebrating. There are stories of Black people trying to leave plantations in eastern Texas and other places to reunite with loved ones. So when we think about the personal as the political, this is as important a holiday for America as July 4th is. And the reason why it's so important is that there was 4 million Americans who were disallowed to be considered citizens, who were disallowed to embody the dignity that they knew they had solely because of race and because of slavery. So Juneteenth provides us a context to understand that, hey, this isn't a story about them. This is a story about us.
At the same time, when we talk about the political, I have to point out there are some strong opposing forces at play in a lot of these conversations, right? We now have a slew of legislative efforts across the country, led mostly by Republican lawmakers, to stop efforts in schools from people teaching about the history of American of racism in America, about the afterlife, as you put it, of our system of enslavement, slavery in America, punishing teachers who try to talk about some of these topics. What does that tell you about where we are?
Well, it tells me that we're a complicated nation. So on the one hand, we've got Juneteenth and supporters of multiracial democracy. On the other hand, we have anti-CRT legislation, and we have the January 6th hearings and supporters of really the past racial status quo that existed during the era of Jim Crow segregation, that existed during slavery. So we are still caught in that bind of folks who believe and support multiracial democracy and those who think about America as a much less inclusive place, as a place that should be dominated just by white male founders. And the founders there would be in quotes, because we know that the founders of the country were actually multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural women as well as men. So I think it just shows me that we are making progress, but we are still caught in the feedback loop of the history that those who don't want us to know about Juneteenth seem determined to deny.
You mentioned the January 6th hearings. So I wondered if you could explain that a little bit. What's the parallel between what you see unfolding there and our conversations around Black history?
Well, January 6th is the grassroots cousin of the racial intolerance that we see used to divide folks politically in the 21st century. So January 6th has real roots in the period of Reconstruction right after the Civil War, where on the one hand, like what Juneteenth reflects, we had a move to reimagine American democracy as multiracial, multicultural. But on the other hand, we had the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. We had the rise of poll taxes and legislation to deny Black voting rights. We had the rise of the convict lease system. But we also had the rise of violent coups against duly elected governments. The peak of that is going to be 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, where an interracial Black and white government is actually violently overthrown. There were all these different versions of January 6th that really led to the end of Reconstruction in the 1870s and the 1880s. So in a way, when we think about Juneteenth taking place against the backdrop of January 6th and legislation to deny the teaching of Black history and deny the teaching of our history of racial injustice, they're all connected. They're all intimately linked. We are an American family collectively, even when there are partisan political and ideological divisions. And I think that Juneteenth allows us a context to explore these divisions, but also explore what unifies us as Americans.
That is Professor Peniel Joseph of the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Joseph, thank you for your time. Always good to have you here.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
For the first time in its history, Colombia has elected a leftist president. Gustavo Petro is a former guerrilla turned mayor of Bogota and then a senator. He defeated right-wing populist Rodolfo Hernandez. As Nick Schifrin reports, his election overturns the right-of-center political establishment that has long run Colombia, and it could usher in a dramatic change in the U.S. relationship with its closest regional partner.
In Colombia's capital last night, a population hungry for change cheered the man who promises transformation. Thousands waved flags and chanted, "Yes, we did it," and hailed Colombia's first ever left-wing president.
A su presidente, Gustavo Petro.
Introduced by the country's first Black vice president, president-elect Gustavo Petro pledged a new path.
En este día, que indudablemente es histórico.
Today is undoubtedly a historic day. We are writing history at this moment, a new history for Colombia, for Latin America, for the world. What is coming is a real change.
For 200 years, we have been governed by the same people. But today begins a transition to the government of change that will benefit all Colombians.
Never before has Colombia elected someone with Petro's past. He fought for M19, the leftist guerrilla group that targeted the Colombian state, and spent 2 years in jail. He became an opposition politician, first mayor of Bogota and now senator. For a country that long marginalized the left, Petro's election is a dramatic departure from decades of right-wing and center-right governments. The 62-year-old became an icon for the country's frustrated youth.
There has been a rising level of discontent, a sense of a lack of opportunity, a sense that education was too expensive.
Cynthia Arnson is a Woodrow Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow. She says Petro's victory is part of a regional anti-establishment shift.
Throughout Latin America, there is a desire for change, to throw out the people that have been in charge over these last very, very complicated, difficult years economically, which have seen rises in inequality and poverty and food insecurity. And so there's a strong anti-incumbent sentiment.
For decades, Colombia has been the United States' strongest regional ally. The two militaries work together. Colombia is the U.S.'s largest regional trading partner. And the U.S. and Colombia have teamed up to fight what the U.S. has called the war on drugs. But Petro calls the drug war a failure and demands to re-examine the trade deal to focus on climate change.
Colombia and the United States have been partners in efforts to suppress coca and the production and export of cocaine. And so shifting away from that and implanting another strategy that is unproven and unknown, I think, is going to create friction.
Another change, Petro's embrace of the regional left. He met with Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez before his death in 2013. Today, Petro vows to create what he calls a progressive partnership with current Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and other regional leftists.
He's very close to Maduro. He's been very close to the Venezuelan dictatorship, and I think he's going to play on that side of the game from now on.
Francisco Santos Calderon was Colombia's former vice president from 2002 to 2010. He says Petro is on the opposite side of history from the United States.
Colombia will probably be more on the side of the autocracies than the democracies. So the U.S. will take a backdoor in policies changing and putting an end to a relationship, a very close relationship between Colombia and the U.S. for the past 30 years.
Petro also vows to upend Colombia's decades-old dependence on fossil fuels and raise taxes on the rich. His victory comes 6 years after the armed leftist rebel group FARC agreed to stop its guerrilla warfare and embrace the political process. Another first in this year's election, Vice President Francia Marquez, a former maid, miner, and farmer turned environmental activist.
And I was really struck in her acceptance speech last night when she talked about this was a government now for the people with calloused hands, for the nobodies in Colombia.
Petro promises a government for the people, but his sweeping reforms may be hard to implement as Colombia ventures into the unknown. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
This month marks 40 years since the brutal killing of Vincent Chin in a suburb of Detroit. The 27-year-old was beaten to death with a baseball bat by two men who were fined $3,000 and received no jail time. The killing sparked calls for justice in his name and a national movement among Asian Americans. Amna Nawaz is back with a closer look at the legacy of Vincent Chin today, part of our ongoing coverage of Race Matters.
Judy, on June 19th in 1982, Vincent Chin, just days away from his wedding, went out to celebrate with friends in Detroit. Later that night, two white men, Ronald Ebbins and his stepson Michael Nitz, attacked Chin and beat him to death. A 1998 documentary, Who Killed Vincent Chin, dove into his story and was later nominated for an Academy Award. It's getting a special airing on POV tonight.
It was a hot night in Detroit, and the men from the auto plants were out for a night on the town. Somebody started a fight. When it was over, Vincent Chin was dead. His head split open with a baseball bat.
Vincent Chin would be alive today if he were not Asian.
Was it a case of racism or a barroom brawl?
God, it's so hard to explain. It's not something you plan on happening, but it happens.
I want justice for Vincent. I want justice for my son. Thank you.
To mark 40 years since Vincent Chin's death, that documentary will air tonight on PBS stations across the country. For more on what followed Chin's death and Asian American identity today, I'm joined by author Min Jin Lee. Her novels include Pachinko and Free Food for Millionaires. She's a writer in residence at Amherst College. Min, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thanks for making the time.
Hello, Amna.
So there are a number of remembrance and rededication services in Vincent Chin's name and memory around the country. But to mark those 40 years, people are remembering what happened that night. And there's still a story that very much resonates with millions of people today. Why do you think that is, 40 years later?
Oh, I think because right now it's probably one of the worst times to be Asian or Asian American in the United States. And that's primarily can be demonstrated through the data that we have seen that since the onset of the pandemic, over 11,000 incidents of hate have occurred and have been reported. It's in the past over a little over a year and a half. And that is what is going on. And that is the experience of Asians and Asian Americans today.
And we have to note, today, Asian Americans are the fastest growing racial or ethnic demographic group in America, also the most diverse, right, in terms of ethnicity and language and faith. But before the death of Vincent Chin, there wasn't a real Asian American identity. I mean, I think it's fair to say his death and the calls for justice that followed helped to really form and shape a community. What should we understand about that?
I think what's really interesting is exactly what you just said. Asian American as a political identity was really formed around his era. And I think that after his terribly tragic murder, what ended up happening was people felt like we need to become more politically important and powerful. And that has occurred. And I think that that's a beautiful legacy of a very tragic event.
It's also really fascinating to me when you look at the historical footage. You see people like Helen Zia, who we saw there in the clip, who was an Asian American civil rights icon. You also see people like Jesse Jackson. There were a number of black civil rights leaders who showed up with Vincent Chin's mother and called for justice in his name. What do we need to understand about how the Asian American movement for justice was built on the black-led fight for civil rights?
Oh, the extraordinary debt that Asian Americans, as well as white women, all oppressed minorities in this country have for African American civil rights movement cannot be understated. And I think that when African American civil rights leaders took up their time and energy and their resources and their political connections to come and support to get justice for Vincent Chin, then that's the reason why it became more remembered. And I think Helen Zia, who is one of the executors of his estate and his memory, has really highlighted this point. And it's so important for us to recognize that, especially this weekend.
You talked earlier about how you think it's a terrible time to be Asian American right now. You wrote a piece for the New York Times earlier this year that was called Asian Americans Have Always Lived With Fear. So I wonder if you, as you reflect back on that, is the fear today the same as it was 40 years ago at the time of Vincent Chin's death, or even earlier? Or is it different and new?
You know, I think ironically, Asians and Asian Americans have faced great hostility since their arrival in this country. That said, there have been moments of great peace as well. The past year and a half and the past, I guess, since the pandemic, almost over 2 years, we saw a greater rise of incidents of violence against Asians and Asian Americans, primarily because since the Trump administration and people who supported his organization have often said that the virus for the pandemic came from China, and then that virus became associated with Asians and Asian Americans. And unfortunately, Asian Americans are often seen as a monolith in which we don't even have a distinct ethnicity or identity, and we are often considered disease carriers and stereotyped as foreigners.
We're talking now of 40 years marked from the death of Vincent Chin, and I wonder, as you look back on everything that's happened in our community and more broadly among marginalized communities here, if there's something good or a lesson that can come out of such a tragic event, what do you think that is today, especially for the next generation?
I think that the greater politicization of Asian Americans and civic engagement to support democracy in this country is a beautiful thing. And I think that unfortunately, you don't want bad things to happen for you to really pay attention to voting. But if we can all be more engaged as good citizens in this country, it's wonderful news out of a tragedy.
Finally, Min, I know the work that you do in your writing, you say you try to humanize people. You try to make sure that you are building bridges in your work. Tell me a little bit about the importance of that narrative work that you do.
I think that within story, it's possible for the reader, as well as a writer, to feel a greater sense of identification with each other and to find empathy. And when we find empathy, we realize that Asians and Asian Americans are not this great horde or a mob, but rather individuals and human beings. And we can feel empathy and sympathy for human beings. And that's a very important role of storytelling. And I hope to be part of that.
That is Min Jin Lee joining us tonight. Thank you so much for your time. Always good to have you.
Thank you, Amna.
Even on this holiday, it is still primary election eve in several states, and midterm election politics never stop. Republican campaigns are ramping up their rhetoric to appeal to base voters. Our Lisa Desjardins breaks down the battle over GOP messaging.
This is a familiar fight. What should the Republican Party values be in November to regain control of Congress? And that's playing out at campaign rallies and ads and across social media in some new ways. To discuss the political stakes of the moment, I am joined now by Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and Tamara Keith of NPR. Thank you both. Let's start with this moment, and let's start specifically with two things that happened over this weekend. I want to play two pieces of sound, and I need to warn our viewers that both of these pieces of sound deal with threats, potentially threats of violence. First, we're going to hear Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, one of just two Republicans on the January 6th committee, talk about new threats to his family. Then we're going to hear from Republican Senate candidate in Missouri, Eric Greitens, with a new ad directed at what he calls Republicans in name only or rhinos. Let's listen.
This threat that came in, it was mailed to my house. We got it a couple days ago, and it threatens to execute me as well as my wife and 5-month-old child. There is violence in the future, I'm going to tell you. And until we get a grip on telling people the truth, we can't expect any differently.
Join the MAGA crew. Get a rhino hunting permit. There's no bagging limit, no tagging limit, and it doesn't expire until we save our country.
And again, we edited those two clips together, but obviously we saw a thread there in both of those. And Amy, my question to you is this another dangerous inflection point in our political rhetoric? Is this more the same? What is this?
No, it certainly feels like we have hit an inflection point, and we're hearing this week on the January 6th commission about threats made to election officials. And of course, we've been hearing in the weeks and months after the 2020 election stories from election officials, even not high-level officials, but folks who are at, you know, the most basic county-level offices, who are nonpartisan, who found themselves targeted by many of these same sorts of threats of violence. The one thing I will say about Missouri, which is the final quote, the final clip that you showed there, this is somebody who really, the fact that he's running at all is quite remarkable. He was forced to resign from office in 2018 as governor after he was accused by a woman he was having an affair with of being aggressive and assaulting her. Most recently, his ex-wife, they're in divorce proceedings right now, accusing him of abusing her and their son. So this is somebody with a history already of being accused of violence who decides, I'm going to run for the Senate, and then keeps playing this violent rhetoric and then is leaning into this violent rhetoric. The unfortunate thing about our politics right now, though, is that this sort of stuff going over the top and extreme, outrageous, it buys you clicks, it raises you money, it gets you attention. And until voters say, that's not okay, this isn't what we do, then those outrages are still going to continue to reap benefits. They see more of a reward than a risk in doing this.
And he's a contender in the August primary.
Absolutely. Right. He's leading in the polling right now.
Right. He is leading in the polling right now. We should say that Facebook has taken that ad down. Mm-hmm. Twitter is putting a warning on it. Right. And yet it is blowing up on social media. It is all over the airwaves because it is so outrageous. And if you're talking about his outrageous ad where he's talking about going rhino hunting, you're not talking about the credible allegations against him, which you put him in a position of both fighting against disloyal Republicans and fighting against the media who are now out here criticizing him. So it works pretty well for someone in a crowded primary field who is trying to consolidate the primary. The language around Adam Kinzinger and that threat against him, the use of the term execution, this is a theme that comes up a lot. There is a glorification of violence, and in particular, sort of a hunger for executions in the mythology of the QAnon cult or whatever you want to call it. And you see this language coming up again and again and again. And there's almost a mainstreaming of totally extreme ideas and language. And those two clips today sort of bridge that in a way.
You know, we had to discuss as a group, do we want to play that full ad or not?
Right.
And we ended up deciding, you know, a lot of times we don't want to give oxygen to that kind of thing, but neither do we want to sanitize it. That is a real ad that is out, that's happening right now.
Yeah.
also happening over the weekend, the Texas Republican Party met at their convention. I want to show some of the things that they voted. They agreed to in one resolution, a resolution that rejected the certified results of 2020 in those words, and also referred to President Biden as the acting president, not legitimate. We also know at the same time it took a court order to force certification of results in New Mexico. You all, we've talked so much about the power of Trump, why there isn't more courage standing up against him from Republicans who we know do oppose him. Perhaps a naive question, what is it going to take, these kinds of things, rejecting elections? When is it going to compel some Republicans to be more public about this problem that's not just a political problem?
Well, and at the same convention, they went after Senator John Cornyn, who right now is working on a bipartisan bill on guns, and Dan Crenshaw, who is a congressman widely regarded as a rising star within the Republican ranks. Those two are more likely to have a future in Congress and in setting policy in Congress than the folks who are sitting at the convention this weekend in Texas. The parties themselves have become so hollowed out. I mean, this is part of the challenge we're having overall, not just in Texas, but in the states and nationally. The parties have become so hollowed out that a credible candidate can take that party over, or you can have people who aren't particularly credible, who don't have the interests of the party in mind, to come in and take that party over. So they've become almost less relevant than ever, even though they get a lot of attention.
Yeah, and in theory, a state party is there to protect and promote the incumbents and to serve the better interests of the party and its establishment. But state parties, and I should say in both parties, state parties have become sort of the outpost of the extreme, where you know, they're censuring their members who have done relatively normal mainstream things, where they pass these resolutions that are completely untethered from what, you know, sort of the mainstream of the party would consider to be,
or their voters,
or their voters, out of line with their voters. They're they are way far from the center of gravity of their party. That said, there are a lot of people whose views are reflected in those resolutions.
One person who advocated for civil talk from everyone, of course, was the great Mark Shields. He sat in these very seats we're in right now. We're all very heartbroken at his loss. Amy, I wanted to ask you to talk about your memories. You've known him a long time.
Yes, and I've done a number of conventions and election nights. Everybody who watched him on the show knows how smart he was and how incredibly gracious he was. To me, the mark of a really good human, which is what he was, is somebody who treats people who aren't as big or important or famous as they are with respect and reverence. And if you walked into this building and watched how he treated every single person on the staff, from desk assistants to interns, you would know what a really good person this was.
He enjoyed conversation with every single person. He kind of could bring out the best in everyone.
He's a good reporter, too.
He's beyond a good reporter,
but beyond,
that's right.
Beyond it being
at
a
his
good
heart.
Thing to do.
He
to
saw
be
the
kind
good
to
in
people.
Politics and
you
the good in people.
You learn a lot by talking to all kinds of people. That's where you learn.
Well, you know, we at NewsHour here do not pick favorites in politics or in sports teams, but I did have to use my own tribute to the great Mark Shields. Put on our mutual favorite baseball hat for the Boston Red Sox.
Absolutely.
Amy Walter and Tamara Key, thank you both.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
And thank you, Lisa, for that. We love that Boston Red Sox cap. And a reminder, we will have full live coverage of the January 6th hearings tomorrow, where the focus is expected to be on the pressure former President Trump put on state election officials to change election results. That starts at 1 p.m. Eastern here on PBS. And now we want to devote the rest of the program to the memory of our dear friend and longtime NewsHour colleague, Mark Shields, who passed away this weekend at the age of 85.
Finally tonight, some Friday night conversation and analysis with and from Gergen and Shields. Shields and G. Go.
And to the analysis of Shields and Brooks, that is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks.
For 33 years, Mark Shields brought his decades of political expertise, unapologetic liberal views, and quick Irish wit to our airwaves, providing critical context and perspective to some of the most historic moments in American politics. Impeachments.
The attitude in the country remains that Bill Clinton lied. They don't want him to leave.
War.
War should not be the first resort. It has to be the last resort.
He lit it up.
White House firsts.
This is a person of enormous talent.
And the 2020 election.
Donald Trump is going out as a sore loser.
A native of Weymouth, Massachusetts, and Red Sox diehard, Mark graduated from the University of Notre Dame in 1959, and for the next 2 years served in the Marine Corps. He cut his teeth in Democratic politics on Capitol Hill and on the campaign trail, working for his political hero, Robert Kennedy, in 68, Edmund Muskie in 72, and Mo Udall 4 years later. He channeled all of those lessons into a column.
As seen by the Gergen Shields 1988 Politics Observation Team.
And as a guest on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, starting weekly during the 1988 presidential election. There from the beginning, his wife of 55 years, Ann Shields.
Whenever there was big political news, they would call Mark, and it just kind of migrated eventually to a Friday night regular venue.
It's the absolute authenticity of the guy.
Mr. Shields.
To our co-founder, Robin McNeil, Mark embodied the goal of the program.
Jim Lehrer and I set out to say, hey, talking heads are some of the most valuable ways of human beings communicate, and why not make the most of it and get the best talking heads we can? And so Mark fitted perfectly into that.
David is wrong in this one instance, okay. And it's the first time tonight.
he challenged his conservative counterparts.
My favorite moments in television have been Friday nights with Mark Shields.
David Gergen was his first sparring partner, sharing the desk with Mark for 6 years.
What is it about him that you think makes him different?
He knows a heck of a lot more about politics than I do. But he had a humility about him as well as that Irish wit that just made him a great partner. Judy, something else in television, as you know, it can be a highly competitive field. And often you may be paired with somebody who you can't quite trust. You never know when you're going to get a knife in the back. I always knew with Mark, I could totally trust him.
There were heated moments.
Mark and I went at it last week because we passionately disagree.
Like during the war in Iraq.
What are we going to do afterwards? Who's going to be with us? Who, are we going to be the first Western Christian pro-Israeli occupying force, military occupying force of an Arab nation in that region?
There's about 12 questions there, David.
I'd say they're all irrelevant.
Still, he always kept it fun.
Mark, they spent 3 hours talking, so what do we assume has taken place here?
Well, we assume, I think, first of all, Judy, that this week will be a yawn.
So we can all go home.
Well, I mean, you know,
we're looking for airplane tickets.
You're not supposed to say that, Mark.
And stayed civil, whether with us at the NewsHour or at CNN's Capital Gang, where he debated the late Robert Novak alongside a good friend, my husband, Al Hunt.
He's interested in a lot of different things, but those things which he's really interested in, politics and family and faith and sports, he gets deeply engaged. He's not a passive observer. We don't need passive observers for things that matter. Sports matter, Judy.
This is the doubleheader.
That love of sports even inspired a Shields and Brooks spinoff.
It was in the newsroom, very casual, no scripts, no pre-interviews, no notes. They both just sat down and we riffed.
This is where we talk about the sport of politics and politics of sport.
He could also drop the velvet hammer on just about anything, not just politics.
That's typical of you. You like everything except America. Yeah. I like American sports. Basketball.
Through the decades, he guided us through elections and presidencies, always with an enduring optimism about public service.
I don't know in a nation as big and brawling, this great continent which we occupy, and diverse as ours, how would we resolve our differences except through the commitment, the passion, the intelligence, the courage of those who are willing to practice the political process and achieve compromise.
And he was beloved in the newsroom for his genuine and cheerful spirit, big heart, and one-liners.
And he caved like a $2 suitcase.
Mark will be missed by our entire NewsHour family, by his wife, Anne, daughter, Amy Doyle, son-in-law, Christo, grandchildren, Jack and Francis, and also, I know, by all of you. Mark Shields was 85 years old.
Here with more remembrances of Mark are two people who knew him well, his daughter, Amy Doyle, and David Brooks of the New York Times, who was Mark's sparring partner here on Friday nights for nearly 20 years.
It means so much to have both of you here with us tonight to think about, to talk about Mark Shields. Amy, I knew him. I was lucky to know your family for, what, 40 years?
My whole life.
Your whole life. Your dad, we knew the Mark Shields. The public doesn't know. Talk about who that Mark was.
The public?
The private.
The private, okay. The private, yes. I mean, he was, well, he's very similar. That's actually the most interesting thing, I think, that his, what, who he was on television and who he was, who Amy mentioned walking around the office, he's the same person. He was a very warm, loving, hilarious, you know, charming person. And, you know, he would make, I mean, my mom, he always made us laugh. He was very, he loved games. You know, he loved playing, as Al mentioned, he loved sports. But he made up games. I mean, my kids joke that he would make up games just to like drive them home from his house. And sometimes he would turn the games a little bit towards himself, where he might win more frequently than lose. But yes.
But he also, I mean, it was clear he was somebody who loved politics. He loved politicians.
Yes.
Where do you think that came from?
I think it came from his parents. I mean, his parents, and they really believed in politics as a way to solve problems. They believed in public service. I mean, I think my grandfather, I'd never met him, but my dad's father, but he was on the school board. He, you know, worked at like a paper company, not blue paper, but, you know, I think he grew up knowing that that was very important. And I think it became a love of his very early on.
And he didn't get discouraged. I mean, surely in the last few years it was different, but over all the years of watching the ups and downs of American politics.
Right.
He maintained that optimism, didn't he?
That's what was so amazing, truthfully. And I still think it's amazing now because I think people my age actually are a lot more disillusioned now, unfortunately, because it's been a rough, you know, past 6 years of politics. There's been some serious ups and downs, and people are so partisan and separate. And I think that's what people loved about my dad and David's interactions and my dad and David Gerges' interactions and all through everything you've done on the show forever is that there was real conversation and real debate. But it wasn't ugly, and it wasn't partisan, and it wasn't like, I can't like you because you're a Republican.
David Brooks, you are joining us tonight from Ireland, and we are grateful for that. Tell us what you're thinking right now.
Well, there was a lot of Ireland in Mark. The warmth, the incomplete lack of pretension, always rooting for the underdog. I'm really struck by the outpouring of warmth that people have, especially since he died. Just the reaction has just been overwhelming to me, and I'm sure to a lot of people. People just responded well to him because they loved and they got the sense of his own personal warmth and generosity. I think the thing that strikes me is how much he formed all of those of us who worked around him. And I remember one time we had not seen footage of Katrina. We happened to be on there live, and we saw footage, Mark and I, for the first time. And Mark reacted with just astonishment that this was America. And through that lesson and through 20 years of lessons, he taught me not to just think with my head, not to just be a pundit through my head or through some party position, but to let your heart be bare and to react with your heart, with the moral emotions you feel. And that was how he improved us all and how he lifted us all.
And David, when he retired from the NewsHour at the end of 2020, I remember you said that he represented the best of American liberalism. What did you mean by that?
Well, he grew up at a time when liberalism was really expanding opportunity successfully. The Fair Housing Act, the Civil Rights Act. He revered Bobby Kennedy, thought he would have been the best president of his lifetime. And so it was a moment of confidence, a moment of confidence in what government can do. And Mark never lost that confidence. And at times in the last few days, I've heard notes that Mark was part of a generation that we're not going to see the likes of again. But when I spoke to him about the time of his retirement, he rejected that. He said he was incredibly optimistic for America. There's a lot of talent there. There's a lot of moral passion that people want to do good for the country. And so he really admired politicians who were willing to lose, willing to be humiliated. He loved Mo Udall. He loved Sergeant Shriver. So many of these politicians who were just big and ambitious in their dreams for what politics could do to improve the lives of the poor and the unfortunate.
What was it like to debate him or to sit next to him and have supposedly different views on Friday nights?
We started out with very different views. And in that 2002 clip of me debating about the Iraq War, what a punk I was. What a jerk. he improved me, as I said. And so it was fun. He was prepared every time. He had those blue pages, and he was taking notes. Here's us at our most sober. And he came to play every single time. And he had the depth of background knowledge of American history, of political history, that he's just brought to bear. And I think one of the things I liked about doing it with him, it wasn't a debate, it was a discussion. And so we were not like trying to prove our party's point. We were just trying to figure out the world. And as Donald Trump came along, we scarcely disagreed at all, to be honest.
Well, where do you think he would, David, where would he dig into that well and find any optimism today? What do you think he'd be saying to us about trying to see the light out of this dark period?
Well, he loved the country. I think God gave him a golden heart. And I never saw him cross, really. He never got cross with me. He used to come to my kid's bar mitzvah, and we were standing up, because that's what we do at the Kiddush after the bar mitzvah, and he sat down on the floor and ate the food, just sitting square, cross-legged on the floor. He just believed in America, believed in unpretentious America. Had a little scorn for anybody who might have a hint of snobbery, but believed in regular Americans and all of us. And so that faith, I think, has never gone away and will never go away in the Mark we know is living somewhere.
How does that sound? When you hear that, Amy.
You know, the word unpretentious came up in my dad actually left on scrabbled papers some things he'd like for his funeral. And he mentioned at the very end, he wanted to invite everyone back afterwards and make sure that we had unpretentious nibbles for everyone to eat.
So including, I'm told, pigs in the
pigs
blanket.
Pigs in a blanket, yes, exactly. So, it's very real. It's very true.
What do you want his legacy to be for your children, his grandchildren, Jack and Francis, and for their generation?
Oh, don't give up on politics. Don't give up on politicians. Believe that government can help people and can help people that are a lot less fortunate than we are. And that's probably the most important thing to my dad, I think, that obviously many people have said throughout the program.
And David, it's tempting just to be so sad right now. Can you give us just a little bit of light as we close out these days thinking about Mark?
Yeah, I have sadness, but what a great life. We would all be fortunate to have a life who was active in politics in a golden age of politics, was a commentator on politics during the Reagan, Clinton, up through Trump, just in consequential times in America. An amazing wife, a marvelous family, left a wide legacy, was beloved. What a great and tremendous life Mark Shields lived.
And countless friends who will miss him so much. David Brooks joining us tonight from Ireland, Mark Shields' home country. And Amy Shields Doyle, the daughter of Mark. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Judy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
And we all have, of course, so many wonderful memories of Mark. There was nobody like him. All of us here, and I mean everyone here, loved him. And we will miss him deeply. Rest in peace, dear Mark. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online, and we'll be here tomorrow starting at 1 p.m. Eastern for live coverage of the January 6th committee hearing. And again, tomorrow evening on the NewsHour. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. and we'll see you soon.